Okay, so I was told to give sort of an informal talk about a bunch of stuff that I do, so this may be not so coherent, but I want to sort of talk about what we're doing that's related to coherent structures and reduced order models. This is many people have contributed to various aspects of what I'm going to talk about. The first part of it is mostly Ishmael, and the second part is mostly Vaughn, who's a former postdoc. So yesterday we talked about this idea of computing exact coherent structures, so I sort of wanted to talk about how I see what we're doing as being sort of complementary perspective. So, you know, if you're trying, in both cases we're really trying to find some simplicity. We're trying to better understand things by either reducing it to these exact solutions and see how these exact solutions relate to the overall turbulence. And so in that sense, you get these sort of coherent structures. And as Wally said yesterday, that term is not particularly well defined, and different people mean different things. And so what I'm going to think about is starting with maybe simplified equations, some of which are based on coherent type structures we observed, and some of which are things like linearizations, which we know are ways to simplify equations, and think about how we get coherent structures from starting with a simplified perspective, and how we also try and figure out how to simplify things from that. Okay. All right. And all of these are sort of analytical rather than data-driven methods that I'm going to talk about in a similar way. So I'm going to talk about two different sort of approaches, one using the linearized Navier-Stokes equations and the idea of using that to sort of identify dynamically important features, which you could call coherent structures, and then also looking at some structural features, some of which came from these dynamically important features here, to get reduced order equations that are nonlinear. So these 2D3C and restricted nonlinear equations, which I'll explain later. So you don't have to understand this, but I like theories, so I like to write the whole equation, because then people will say, oh, but what are those terms? So you can see the terms, but you can ignore them and just look at this. So I'm thinking of a linearization about a laminar flow here. And this is really very old work that we're going to build upon in what I'm talking about. And this is mostly by Bompier and Jovanovic, and lots of other people have looked at other types of linear analysis, but we're looking at linearization around a laminar flow with perturbations from laminar. So all of these equations are in terms of these perturbations from laminar. And this is the Orff-Sommerfeld square form that I'm looking at here. And where really, so this is my operator. So I've done the projection onto the divergence free plane. And my output is my velocity field. And I Fourier transformed this, and that's what all these hats mean. And so this is basically the system of equations that I want to look at. And what I'm really interested in is an input-output analysis. And that's why I'm talking about mostly what Bomier and Jovanovic had done, is so looking at applying some sort of disturbance to these equations, and then looking at the output in terms of the velocity field. And so you can look at that in a number of ways. You can look at the impulse response from this. You can look at norms. And what I think is interesting in how this connects to some of these coherent structures is when you look at things like the impulse response. So this is an impulse response that Mihailo and Bassam had looked at, where they did an impulse response at one of the walls. You get these sort of structural features that come out. This is a dominant mode that comes out that looks very much like some of the structural features you observe. So you're looking at a linear operator, you're doing this input-output analysis, and you're getting things that look like coherent structures that you can actually define based on what's amplified the most in these systems. Yes?
Can you tell us what features we should be looking for in common between these two?
So it just has a similar shape.
Can you show us this?
So this, I mean, if you look at this, is the streamwise direction here, and this is a picture I stole from Bassam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is the streamwise direction here. You can kind of see you've got this sort of triangular high-speed thing and low-speed thing in terms of the velocity field that are going here, and then you also have sort of the back end that looks kind of similar.
I
here.
See the front end. I'm not sure. I don't see the
back. I think they look similar, but We can agree to disagree there.
The scale on X and Z are different, so it should be stretched out.
Ah, the scale.
And as I said, I took this picture from something Bassam said. It was just to sort of make the point that you...
No, that's true.
The spot of the light is in the is not in the Y direction.
This is the X direction.
This is X and Z. And it, and you
yes.
explain in the Y and X. It's different than the tip. Y and X and the T and X and Z.
Okay, so yeah, the scale is what.
Yeah, I think that's the problem.
Stretch this bottom thing out and make it equal scale.
I'll ask him for a different picture.
Well, you can just.
I can't give you a
just pull it out.
Picture is exact.
Okay.
Just pull it out. even though the text will be wrong, that's okay. It'll be.
Okay. Well, so that was a very poor illustration.
What Jovanovic and. Bamiya did, because
I
don't know that paper, I don't know anything.
So basically they just looked at the impulse response, and then they looked at the KX and KZ modes that came out as the most amplified ones. And once you do that, you get, you know, you get two basis functions that you can use to reconstruct the shapes. So this is
a linear framework. Sorry, maybe this confused you, but what is an impulse response?
Basically, you're putting in like an infinite disturbance at a particular point in space here.
Green's function.
It's constructed a Green's function.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just,
yeah.
Okay. So exciting.
Yeah, that's
Green's function.
Sorry, that wrong audience,
okay.
But yes, that's the way to explain it.
But within a linear framework.
Yes.
So then that comes to, but a spot is a profoundly nonlinear structure. So why?
So, as I said, I'm reviewing other people's work. I was just trying to make a connection between that you do actually in these linear things, and I don't know necessarily why you see this, but looking at these linear operators, you get things that come out that look like these structures that do come from profoundly nonlinear types of behavior.
Jet-lagged. It's my hobby horse. Sometimes. Yeah, but you know, can you make generic statements about when the linear?
No. My point that I'm trying to make, obviously not very well. I said possibly incoherent at the beginning, just as a caveat. But is that you are sometimes able to start with these simplified equations, and instead of getting exact coherent solutions from the full equations, you can get some intuition as to what these structures look like by starting with simplified equations. And it gives us some ideas about how to study the flow in different ways.
There's also the saturated amplitude is always going to be free, right?
Yes.
You don't know that either within the linear problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's different, you know, these are the things, and you know, I think Adi made a really nice point, is some of these things we do to make progress and to try and start understanding. These are problems we know how to solve. We have lots of tools from linear systems theory, so this is a really nice place to start, because this is something we really know how to handle. Yes?
You know better than I do, but my impression is that these authors, Mihailo and Bassam, would say that a turbulent spot is not a nonlinear structure at all. That they'd say that it's just a linear phenomenon resulting from excitation by something like wall roughness or some random disturbance will give you that structure. And their evidence was that picture you just showed. Do I have that right? Do I understand?
I believe that's what they would say, but I don't know enough of... I haven't spent a lot of time talking to them about that particular spot, but yes. But I agree that would be the answer that Bassam would give me if I asked him that. But he's not here, so I'm not going to speak for him.
In the next building, we should get it.
ten years ago, almost exactly, I came here on a day trip to see Bassam, and he did say exactly that.
Yes.
And my disagreement with him, this was a great influence on me and, you know, inspiration, etc., of what these two guys did, looking at the linear operation. But the point of difference was that top diagram, they don't have feedback, they do use external excitation, being Gaussian disturbance, roughness, etc., etc. My point of view was that it's a feedback loop.
Right.
That was the main difference.
Yes.
So yes, he specifically did, at that time, he did say that.
Yes.
Can I comment?
Yeah, sure.
Make a rough statement, but that's the statement as well. This is not true even for flow around the cylinder, right? Yes.
Yes.
If you try to do linearization around
It's I mean, and these, but these are different flows. One of the reasons it's true here is because you have the strong shear, which is different than what you get from flow around a cylinder. So it's a different type of flow.
The question here, so the statement is, this is not true in general.
That's right. Absolutely.
The question here is, when is it? So it's clearly relevant in some very, very interesting cases. I like to connect this to our mean flow analysis discussion, because it might be that in many cases it's actually roughly, so in more cases it's true when your linearization is around the mean flow and not around
And I should say
which they
that
didn't consider.
I should say that a lot of this is based on the fact that we're thinking about wall-bounded shear flows. And so so we're not thinking about flow around a cylinder. This is really thinking about wall-bounded shear flows, and that's what I should have had a slide focusing on that.
That did not mean in the sense that it invalidates anything that you've said.
No, but I think that's a very important point, is that a lot of these things for wall-bounded shear flows, you get different things because of the role of the wall. And I think that's actually a very, very important point, especially in these linear analyses, to think about. And that may be why you have counterexamples in other types of flows.
Maybe we should postpone this to the mean flow, but you can show in certain asymptotic limits that this is true. The question is, how far away from the asymptotic limit can you push your analysis to get
it? But do you mean in the wall-bounded shear flow, or do you mean...
Well, just in systems in general,
take a cylinder and take a fixed flow.
Yeah, for that one, maybe not, but for certain systems, with non-trivial means, then you can do an asymptotic expansion perhaps and get this exact result. But then the question is, with all asymptotic results, how far does it kind of push through? And what is the correct asymptotic parameter?
Okay, but look, I'll say my... So I think that the patterns you see in these wall-bounded shear flows are dominated by interfaces between the turbulent and the laminar flow. Okay. And they're very, very far from linear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. But on the other hand, the structures that they get are very, very interesting.
Yeah, but quite falsified.
Sorry, I have a question. Many times, you have understood, and this plot, for example, at internal Reynolds number, are very well described by linear transient growth. By example, this spot that I showed yesterday, and Vasseur flow at Reynolds 1000, the spot grow, this is exactly the spot you showed, grow and decay, and the maximum time is exactly the time given by the theory of the linear. These spots are absolute strike rolls, streaks, and after, when you have a higher Reynolds, not works more than this linear theory, when you have Reynolds. But the initial spot you observe in experiments are any relation with the linear theory, but the fact, I ask, this is my question, the fact that the maximum time of the growth is exactly what you observe in the experiment. So you don't need, and this is my question, perhaps this non-linear waviness or waviness instability to analyze what happened in the beginning.
And that's not clear. And I think, I think that's a transient phenomenon that you're talking about. So it kind of makes sense that you get it from...
You have walls, you have a confined shear flow, you have streaks, you have all the elements. It's not far from the paper. And after, when you have higher Reynolds number, no. When you have waviness and waviness, it's huge.
So are these turbulent spots that result from a streak breakdown?
That's what you're saying, yeah. That's what you're saying, it chooses to be linear, is precisely.
Question.
Using the waviness, basically streak breakdown.
Yes.
So my surprise is actually that it works in this kind of transitional situation, because there the fluctuations about the mean are greatest. I mean, if you go to higher Reynolds numbers, the fluctuations about the mean actually become energetically proportionally much, much smaller. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised that the POD type, the resolvent mode analysis kind of gives some nice features or works quite well there. But in transitional regime and the spot, don't get it.
And it's a different question because the mean that he's using is different than the mean that I'm using. So actually, the mean that he's using, the fluctuations are much smaller because he's using a time average mean flow, which is something I'm going to talk about later. So in this case, the fluctuations are bigger in some sense.
So yours is not the mean, right?
It's not the mean, it's the laminar flow.
It's the laminar flow. I said that at the beginning. It's laminar flow, right? Here. Yes.
Laminar.
Oh, these are laminar.
Laminar flow.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And this is all done about the laminar flow.
But that's, I mean, at the inception, you have certain.
I mean, this is just input output. This is not a stability analysis. This is saying, you know, what types of things are most amplified in the system in some sense. I mean, this is saying, you know, minimum input, maximum output.
Yes,
so it's just really asking you.
So the mean flow, and the mean flow is varying.
But this isn't. This has nothing to do with the mean flow because I'm just looking at. This is a linearization, a true linearization about a laminar flow. So this actually, the mean flow is not relevant in what I'm talking about here.
For the spot, it definitely is.
Well,
the mean flow is spatially dependent.
The analysis doesn't have any footprint of the mean flow. I'm looking at something that's about laminar. I don't put anything regarding the mean flow in here.
No,
the mean flow is included in these fluctuations. Right.
Dangerous.
Perhaps. Okay. So this is just sort of a review of previous results that I'm going through. So, I mean, you can also look at these input-output norms. So this is an H2 norm, which I'll define a little bit more carefully later, and see that the most amplified structures or the input-output response are these sort of streamwise coherent structures. And I'll talk more about that later. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because we wanted to look at this in terms of viscoelastic flows, but Mike's not here. But anyway, we looked at the Oldroyd-B equations and looking about linearizing these again about a laminar flow, and we can argue whether or not that's the right thing to linearize them about, but these are what the results in the literature that I'm reviewing do. And so here, if we look at these equations, we've linearized them about the laminar flow, and now we don't just have velocity states, we also have these polymer stress states, this tau. And so when we look at this, this A operator is going to include both the polymer stress, the conformation tensor, as well as the velocity states. And so when I'm looking about linearizing this and I'm looking about my inputs and my outputs, all I'm looking at is inputs that are disturbances applied to the velocity field here, and my outputs are related to the velocity field. So I'm sort of limiting the inputs and outputs here. And so if you do that, you put disturbances in the velocity field, and you look at the outputs as the velocity flow, and you look at the energy amplification. So this is related to this 2 norm. So essentially, you're just looking at the energy in U. You get very similar pictures that you did before. And you get these same types of structures in viscoelastic flows, which is very interesting. And you do observe these structures in viscoelastic flows as well. And if you look at the scaling of the energy amplification with at kx equals 0, which is the dominant mode, you get something that scales very similarly to the way the amplification scales in terms of Newtonian flows. And this is Hoda et al. So this is, again, out of Mihailo Jovanovic's group with Kumar as well at Minnesota. So you can get that. And what we wanted to think about there is how viscoelastic parameters affect this behavior. And if your structures start to change, if you think about amplification of sort of a viscoelastic energy, as opposed to just looking at how the velocity field is. And if we can learn more about the structures in viscoelastic flows, the same way, if you agree, which there's not a lot of agreement, that you're getting some information about structure, can we get this information about structure by looking at this problem slightly differently? So what we did now is we looked at disturbances on both the velocity field and the polymer, and these disturbances could be that, you know, in the Oldroyd-B model, we make certain modeling assumptions. They may not be completely accurate. So that could be one of the disturbances you have in this type of system. It could be nonlinearities in the velocity field, as Clancy mentioned. There's other types of disturbances, walls, et cetera. And then we're looking at an output, which is now both the velocity field and the polymer stress. So now we have a viscoelastic kinetic energy, which is now this H2-type norm and a Frobenius norm associated with this, because this is a tensor, not just a vector like the velocity is. And so, same slide again where I'm just labeling these things. Sorry about that. So it turns out that this kind of changes things. And when you have low elasticity, you get this sort of viscous scaling that we had before, but you get this sort of elastic correction term, which is really interesting. And it actually changes the dominant structures that you start to see by having this elastic correction term. And then at high elasticity, what's very interesting is that you actually get this cubic scaling with the Weisenberg number instead of the Reynolds number now. And you get a viscous correction to what's going on. So there's a nice analogy here between what we do in the Newtonian flows and what we got when we looked at the input-output response in terms of just the velocity field with the viscoelastic correction. And this leads to changes in the types of structures that are dominant. You no longer get the same spacing of structures, and it may lead us to some insight in what's going on. And Ismail can tell you more details about this. So the other thing that I was thinking that I was going to talk about is really using these ideas from linear analysis about these streamwise coherence being the dominant structures, and also looking at observations, using this to drive how we restrict the Navier-Stokes equations to look for simplified models. And so I'm going to talk about two different types of simplified models that come directly from insights that we gain from identifying these dynamically important features, as well as from experiments and looking at the structures. So if you look at this, if you look at a flow, so this is from the turbulence database. This is a channel flow that's at RE tau of 1,000, and you sort of zoom in, you see these streamwise elongated structures all over the flow. So these are high-speed velocity contours in red and low-speed ones in blue, and if you look at them this way, you can sort of see these long streaky structures, and this is a nice visualization from Beverly's group that shows sort of this idea of these long regions of high and low momentum that you get. And we know that these elongated streaks and vortices dominate in the near wall region. There's longer structures that have been found throughout the height of the channel that are actually energetically dominant. These sort of so-called superstructures, very large scale motions, lots of different names for them. And so we also know, as I said before, that these show maximum growth in studies of the linearized Navier-Stokes equations. So we wanted to think about a model that connects these structural features to the velocity shape. So I'm going to look at plane Couette flow in this part of the talk. So the idea is, how do these structures tell us more about how we acquire the mean velocity here? So here I am actually talking about more of a turbulent mean velocity profile as opposed to looking at fluctuations about laminar. And so in order to study this problem, what we're going to think about is taking the Navier-Stokes and decomposing it into a streamwise constant mean and perturbations about that mean. So we're looking at things that look like this in this equation, and then in the other equations, we're looking at things that have streamwise variation. So this is just the Navier-Stokes. I've just decomposed it in a strange way. I took the streamwise constant part of this perturbation of these Reynolds stresses and moved it back up here. So all of this is streamwise constant, and all of this is streamwise varying. So there's no streamwise constant component of this at all. So if we think about that, we want to think about what's going on with the streamwise constant velocity field. So rather than taking these things from the perturbation, I just give some sort of streamwise constant forcing to this, and think about this as being a flow that's just evolving in two dimensions. So we call this a 2D 3C model because it's a two-dimensional flow, but we have all three velocity components so that it sort of captures more of the 3D nature of turbulence. So the idea is that this is really a model where the structures all look like this. And so another reason to do this is because it may give us some insight into momentum transfer that leads to the appropriate shape of this turbulent velocity profile. And there's been a lot of previous work that has shown that this is really this nonlinear equation that we now are left with, that streamwise constant, gives us this type of momentum redistribution that leads to this velocity profile shape. So in order to think about this, we just take these equations, we make that F that I talked about, this forcing stochastic noise, we apply it to this 2D3C model, and we get out the three components of the mean flow. And so what happens then is we see we do actually get the correct shape of the mean velocity profile. So this is just the normal mean velocity profile averaged in time. And we also get, so this is now the 2D cut, because the 2D3C is actually a two-dimensional flow. So this is Y and Z. This is just a snapshot in time. And you can see from a DNS, we are just taking a snapshot in the Y and Z plane, and we get something that looks somewhat similar.
How do you know what to force it with? Is what amplitude and what everything else?
So the answer to that is I use basically, 1% turbulence intensity is something like what the variance of the forcing should be, and it gave me a good velocity profile.
Uniform? You just took it uniform.
Everything was white space and time. Well, I mean, it's delta correlated in space and time to the size of the spatial filter, but it's just basically white, yes.
But your F doesn't vanish on the average, because it has this U grad U from the fluctuation part, and that gives
So my F here that I put in for, I went totally the wrong way. Where am I? Sorry. So this F I'm putting in is just stochastic noise. There's no U grad U here. I'm just playing with the mean flow equation. So the real F, if I'm thinking about how this came about, it comes from this. But what I'm saying is I just want to understand what's going on here in this mean flow dynamics. And I just want to understand that by itself. So I'm just applying stochastic forcing to this. It's just white. It isn't U dot grad U here, it's just stochastic noise.
There's the U dot grad U.
The important part, question that I was asking is whether this F vanishes on average or not.
It's zero mean.
It's zero mean.
Yes. Okay. It's zero mean.
So it doesn't depend on Y and Z.
It does depend on Y and Z.
So is it stochastic?
It's zero mean at every point.
Sorry.
In space. Yes. Yeah. It's a stochastic forcing at every point in space and time. It depends on Y, Z, and T. So it's stochastic, and it's white in Y, Z, and T.
Mihailo, I think, is going to talk about next week is identifying the term.
For a different problem.
But he gets colored noise.
Right. But that's for linearized equations, whereas this is nonlinear. So it's a different problem.
Yeah, it's streamwise average here. It's different.
I just think that the point that they're making is an interesting point.
I agree, but I don't think it's related to this point.
The stochastic modeling goes back to Andy Maida, I think, at least. That's my recollection. And they've been using white noise in time and space as
right.
well. But to my mind, the interesting question is it white? And I don't think it is, personally. But.
So this is not a fluctuation.
So I'm not trying to identify the noise. All I'm trying to identify is whether or not I'm getting momentum redistribution from this equation. And in order to do that, I want to put in something that is generic so that I'm not putting in structure into the problem. So I want to put in unstructured noise and see if I get structure out, because that basically tells me if this equation is giving me structure out of noise. Yes?
It's beautiful. There's not criticism.
Yeah.
What I'm about to say, but the U dot grad, if this were the Navier-Stokes equations, your F is indeed is that, and I think it goes right to the heart of what Igor says and about the colouring of this noise.
Right.
There's real physics dynamics about that term, and
absolutely.
Why should white not? Why is the physics represented well or perfectly or optimally by white noise? And I don't see that is
given. That's an assumption.
No, and actually, that's not the question I'm asking. But I don't actually think that physics is represented at all by the white noise. Yeah. All the white noise is telling me is whether or not this set of equations is basically a low rank operator that brings you to a certain type of behavior. Yeah. So that's all that this is telling me. I think in the second part of this, I am actually going to replace this with if you got drag you and show that actually is more physically meaningful. In this case, all I want to know is essentially, you know, if I put in something generic, where do I go? And that sort of tells me, do I have something that's high gain and low rank in the sense that no matter what I put in, I always get out the same thing? And that's one of the reasons to put in something that has no structure to see if you get structure out. And we kind of know that this equation is high gain because we get these really big input-output norms. And the question is, do you go to sort of the same lower dimensional manifold every time, no matter what you sort of put in? And that's really the question that is of interest in terms of putting in white noise to this equation. So I agree with you that there's physics there and that's important, but I don't, my argument here isn't that I'm trying to get at the physics of this. I think that's a really interesting question. You know, what should the physics of this be? And is there a simpler way to generate it than having this, all of this stuff here? But for this, I'm just trying to say is, do I really just get momentum transfer from this? And to understand if I really get the appropriate momentum transfer from this, I want to see, am I getting structure out of noise? Does that sort of address?
Well, if it is answering the question that you're interested in, query is that you're saying, I thought you were presenting it to say that when I put in white noise, I get a mean flow that looks like a Navier-Stokes solution mean flow.
Right.
So that then kind of, that suggested to me that the fine physics that is in U dot grad U average with X doesn't matter to give you the mean flow.
It does in the sense that I did put in some amplitude or some variance of the noise. Right. And the point here is that I'm getting the appropriately shaped velocity profile and that I'm getting sort of this structure that looks correct. The quantitative reproduction sort of gives me a proof of concept that I can do that, but it's really not the key point here. My point is really that I'm getting the momentum transfer and that no matter what I put in, I get this new momentum transfer. And, you know, in order to say, you know, in order to sort of sell this idea, you need to show that you can get the right mean flow appropriately with this noise. But the idea really that I really asked about at the very beginning when I started this is, do we get this momentum transfer leading to the turbulent mean velocity profile? And so is that the structure I'm getting out of putting the noise? And so whether or not this matches exactly like it does here, or it sort of looks like the right shape, I'm still getting that momentum redistribution that I'm interested in. So I'm still getting the structure of the flow. I might not be quantitatively capturing the flow, but the point here is, am I getting the right structure? And that's really what I'm interested in asking. Does that?
Yeah,
I'm done. Okay. Yeah, maybe I should have put this at the beginning. I saw a hand over here. Okay. So this tells me basically I'm reproducing the momentum transfer. Doesn't tell me anything about turbulence being self-sustaining, but sort of at large scale, this is giving me sort of the right behavior. So if I want to think about a mean flow, this might be an appropriate type of mean flow to think about. And so when we get back to these questions about mean flow, that's one of the reasons what we're thinking about this is, does this give me the right mean type of behavior? And it's not a time average mean, it's actually a time varying mean. And that's sort of key in what I'm doing here. So if we then go back to these full equations, where I had this sort of mean perturbation coupling that, you know, where I actually have some structure that's driving this mean flow, and then I also have this perturbation nonlinearity, I can then take these equations and think about doing a dynamical restriction to get my restricted nonlinear system. And the way that we do this, and there's details in some of these papers, is we take this perturbation nonlinearity, and we parameterize it as some little e. You can set it to zero, you can parameterize it as stochastic noise, or do whatever. And the reason that you might want to do this is then you can actually form a second order closure here, where the way this is parameterized basically talks about how you're closing these equations. And in that case, you get an equation in terms of the mean, and you then use this to build a covariance. So you can evolve the mean and the covariance. I'm going to talk about it in this way because trying to simulate mean and covariance and evolve this in time is just computationally intractable. And so I'm going to look at it in terms of this perturbation field. And so the idea here is now I have this restricted nonlinear model where I have this dynamical restriction where I took out these streamwise varying interactions in the flow. So I still have interactions between things that have spanwise variation and things that have streamwise variation. I just don't have any interactions between two, you know, K1 and K2 if I do a Fourier decomposition. And so I have these mean flow dynamics that are basically regulating the size of these perturbations through this perturbation equation through these terms here. But these perturbations now are driving the mean flow, and they're setting it to the right size and the right shape. And this is the structure that we actually need. So this F being of this structure is actually what's needed to get you the right thing. Because this is the physics that's kind of important, is really having both of these interactions. And so if we think of this, as I said before, if we look in Fourier space, the streamwise constant dynamics are all at kx equals 0, and the streamwise varying perturbations are all at kx not equal to 0. And so we can think of then simulating this to see what we get out of it. We use this parameterization just to initiate the turbulence now, and then we turn it off. And so we have this equation that's now linear in U. You can think of it as a linearization around this mean flow at any point in time, if you want to think about it that way. And then we have this nonlinear sort of 2D3C equation that's driven by the streamwise constant component of the perturbations. And so again, we get this nice mean velocity profile shape that looks good. We get this at a substantially reduced computational cost than you do with DNS. And I'm not going to talk about that in detail, but it's one of the nice features of this model. And we get self-sustaining turbulence, where if we look at the RMS of the velocity minus the laminar in both the DNS and our RNL, we initiated turbulence in both models in exactly the same way with the stochastic forcing. And then when we turn it off, we really don't get big differences. So we've really got a self-sustaining flow at this point, and it's really this interactions where we're actually putting the right structure of the noise into the mean flow. And we're creating that structure of the noise by having something that satisfies Navier-Stokes that we're also simulating as well. So this is what the flow fields look like. They look nicer, partially because I got better at visualization software between the first ones and the second ones. But the feature spacing is also more accurate here. And so the other thing that we wanted to then look at is more quantitative measures of what's going on with this flow. And we can do that by looking at some of the structures that we know are really important. So if we think of this SSP, Wally's originally proposed, we can think of defining these streaks mathematically and these roles mathematically and sort of looking at the time evolution. And there's lots of ways people define streaks. I'm not saying this is the right way, but this is how I'm defining the streaks in terms of how I measure them. And they're a little bit different than the streaks that are defined in this community. And I think this is one of the reasons that when we talk and we say, oh, well, the streaks are breaking down and they get all snaky, well, my streaks can't do that because I'm actually taking the mean flow, which is streamwise constant to begin with. So these streaks that I'm looking at are different in that sense. And I'm actually very interested in seeing how we can relate these theories together by trying to make a more more cohesive definition of some of these quantities. But that's an aside.
That's a spanwise average.
This is a spanwise average. So it's basically, this is a streamwise constant thing, and I'm subtracting the spanwise average. So it's basically sort of a variation across the span that I'm looking at in terms of the streak.
So it measured the spanwise variation.
Right, exactly, which is different. But this is how we're defining the streak. This is Brian and Petrus's definition that we started with, and so I'm using that. And then we're defining the roles again as being streamwise constant things, which are this v squared and the w squared. So these are all streamwise constant quantities. How am I doing with time? Should I speed up?
Should we go back one slide?
Yeah.
Maybe two slides, another one. So here you're comparing RNL, DNS, and if you go back one more slide, the X is streamwise kind of grid.
Yeah.
How would an LES with a similar number of streamwise points do compared to these? I mean, I'd expect it to do this probably just as well. What's the advantage of your RNL?
It won't necessarily do just as well, and we don't need to have some sort of subgrid model, and we don't need to have a wall model.
But at least you know what you're trying to model.
Yours is an LES. If you look at your system of equations, you could describe that your small bit is a subgrid scale model. And you're mainly connecting. It's just semantics, right? Yours is an LES. You evolved the big U, and you have a model for the little U.
I think you could look at it that way. Certainly, it's not modeling the same thing that an LES thing is modeling, but it's a similar idea where you have a large scale equation that interacts with a small scale equation, and the reason that it works is because you know the large scale is, you know, accurately reproducing the large scales, and you have a small scale thing that you kind of understand what that model should be.
If you think the decision is the large small scales, it's mean and fluctuations.
Well, the mean is kind of the large scale behavior.
It's different from an LES. An LES has a different decomposition.
I never said it was an LES. So I said you could think of it that way, as he suggested.
No, but I think I would argue it is, because it's the large scale in terms of the streamwise dependence. Right, it is the large streamwise invariant structures are being forced by the streamwise variant structure.
So it depends on how you define an LES, but it is very much a large scale, small scale thing. It's just which scales you're interested in is the question here.
Okay, so it's an anisotropic LES, if we can think of it like that. But what's the advantage of doing it this way, which seems like a global approximation, whereas at least LES, you're making local approximations?
This is computationally more tractable than an LES when you start to get to high Reynolds numbers. I do know. But
why is that computationally more tractable? I mean,
that's a question I could answer offline if you want, because it would require me breaking out a whole bunch of other slides to show you how we're actually computing these things and talking about in what sense this is a minimal model and all sorts of things I'm not presenting here.
An LES, all I have is a very simple 1-line equation for a local eddy viscosity. Why is that computationally more?
As I said, I can show you, I can hand-wavingly explain it right now. It's not going to provide you a very good answer to your question. I'm happy to talk to you about it offline, but I don't think it's...
I'm just wondering.
I'm computing... The way that I'm going to compute this is I'm going to take a 2D grid with no Fourier transforms in the third direction is how I'm going to actually compute this, and an LES is a 3D grid.
So this
can be computationally much more attractive, but I would actually have to show you how I'm computing it in order to explain that and also explain some other things that I just don't have slides about here. Yes?
In some sense, it seems like the coupling between the large and the small
is
less of a guess than it is in a typical LES.
Right. Yeah.
A lot less.
I would agree with that statement, but... I'm not an expert in LES, so I can't say, you know, that's irresponsible speculation on my part, and I don't like to do that publicly.
Just a
privately, I'm okay.
Denise's model, in certain limits, has conservation laws that are respected by her model. That you have to be very careful to respect in an LES.
That's my point.
So it kind of comes out naturally.
It seems less.
Yeah. I'm not enough of an expert in LES to speculate about that.
Over what you're
yes.
So instead of thinking about this as an LES,
like I'm going to think about it as a DNS where you dropped one term, the E, right? Yeah. So like if you by some method knew which E was the correct E, then you would actually completely reproduce the DNS.
Yeah.
You could certainly do that if you could properly model the E. So you could do this kind of like with some sort of low order model for the E, and maybe you could completely reproduce this, absolutely.
But my question is that I mean, you can actually calculate what the E is from the DNS. Like what is
you could.
So have you looked at that to see what that looks like if maybe that would give you an explanation for why just dropping it seems to be a good
I can't find someone to do that calculation for me right now, but I would really it is something that we've talked about looking at, but I don't have the bandwidth to do that right now. But it's certainly something that I think is a very interesting question.
It must be smaller in this case. Yeah. There are cases where I mean it's like
the third cumulative.
Well, but this is exactly again where I said this is it's particular to the types of flow that I'm looking at. This I don't think this would work for the flow that Loretta's analyzing. Sorry.
Can someone speak for Loretta?
No, no, no. I said I don't think this would work. I'm not speaking for her. Yeah. So I'm not speaking for her. I'm just saying that I don't know that it would work as well. Although people have looked at this for a Taylor-Couette flow.
What's the definition of your aims?
It's just a way. It's a parameterization. I didn't define it.
It's a difference between that and the never full never spoken
voice. It's a parameterization of this. Here, there we go. It's a parameterization of this.
So this is my F.
Yeah.
But you don't care what. But
no, this isn't your F because part of your F is here as well.
That's my F.
Your F is all of these. Your F is all of these things together and a little bit different because your U isn't time varying. So it's related.
What can you do if you had the case where you had a spatially varying geometry? Can you still do something like this?
I don't know. It depends on the type of flow. Again, I don't wildly speculate in public.
Fair enough.
You can, but it's more expensive.
I mean, if it's streamlined homogeneous, right? If it's homogeneous, it's streamlined direction.
Yes, that's important.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I mean, it could be homogeneous in some sort of transformed dimension. So I don't know. Well, yeah. I mean, this is how I separated the equations. As I said, I kind of know what my mean flow should be because I know the physics of my problem, and then I tested that idea by just putting white noise in to see if that was really giving me some of the large-scale physics of the problem. I said, yes, it is, so this is probably a pretty good mean flow because actually this is, you know, goes back to your point you made earlier. Now I know sort of the fluctuations about this are pretty small, which actually makes me able to make this scale separation argument, in my mind, a little bit crisper.
But Ali, it comes back to what you said about if you know there's a symmetry in the problem, you should use it. No,
right.
If it's more complicated geometry, then you may still have a symmetry, maybe not a continuous symmetry, but you know, some symmetry that you can explore.
Yeah, but you can have a symmetry in the domain or in the equations, but the solutions don't respect.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this really requires you to have some sort of strong shear or something that's, you know, really giving you this scale separation, I think. I don't know for sure, but I think the way I think about it, that's.
Can this be compared to computational on the path? So this is almost like a quasi 2D simulation,
sure.
And then if you notice the equations, they're linear functions of x, so you have no convolutions.
Well, I mean, I think to make that point, one needs to show a lot more details than I'm going to show. And that's
then
that was my
that
point.
Resolution would also be a quasi 2D.
Well, but then
yeah,
it might blow up.
You'd probably be able to reduce the other parameters and get very similar. I think you'd probably be able to reduce the resolutions in the other dimensions.
I'm not going to compare this to LES because I haven't done the calculations directly, and I do think it's a different approach to the problem. I think for me this is I'm computing the other part of it that's respecting some sort of physics that I understand. I think LES is used for different things for different reasons.
Can I just understand?
It's not just a compute. I'm not trying to just compute something. I'm trying to.
So if I have a spectral DNS code, what I would do to simulate this with E equals zero is simply cut off some of the terms and the nonlinearity. Is that not the case?
No, so, you'd cut off all of the K not equal to zero interactions with K not equal to zero.
That's right.
So K11, K12. Yes.
And so the speed comes from, I mean, I realize you're after understanding that speed. But the speed comes from the fact that I'm only using a few modes in the streamwise direction.
Yeah. So the speed.
You're still going to have to do all the Fourier transforms.
No, you don't. If you're not, it's much faster. I can show you some results. I just don't have them yet.
You do the spanwise transforms for each of those, right?
Yeah, but if I already started with the DNS code, surely I'm just going to have Fourier transforms. Sure.
Well,
I have to evaluate. Yes.
But you don't have to do X transform.
But I have to evaluate you there. That's not streamlined.
You don't.
That thing there. But you can do it. But it's diagonal.
You don't have to do Fourier transforms. I can guarantee you don't because we've done it. And actually, I have a nice thing that shows you the diagonal thing that Laurette was talking about. I just don't have that slide here. I could probably find it, but I don't.
Denise, could I ask a question? Motivated by what you said, not about this LES representation topic.
Okay.
You said this system doesn't blow up, which I find very interesting. When you showed the equation, you have little u dot is a big u. Can you put the equation up? It's a bit hard for me to speak.
This
here.
One?
Yeah, the top one, right?
Yeah.
Now, simple-mindedly, when you put E equals zero, that looks like it'll either increase or decrease, right? It looks a profoundly unstable problem.
Yeah.
And yet,
unless it's stable at every point in time.
Yeah, but that's not the case, right? Because U doesn't just go up, right?
That's
absolutely, and that's the very point I'm making.
Yes.
The time variation is just such to keep that tiger, little u, finite amplitude, but not increasing.
Yeah, the Lyapunov exponent has to be zero here.
Yeah, and I find that very interesting. Why?
Yeah.
And you know, is that
gets at some of the discussions about mean ability.
Yes.
A different sense.
And
this is related to why I think this limit cycle, I mean this marginally stable argument, I think it's related to this that we were talking about yesterday. Because this actually has to have, you know, this has to be marginally stable.
It has to be marginally stable for what you are doing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But the logic turnaround is why is it marginally stable?
I don't know about that.
Yeah, and that's
kind of I would love to figure that out.
Yeah.
And maybe some of your tools would be things to look at there.
Energy is conserved in the system.
I don't even know where to look.
Let me ask
you. Yes.
It's because you're requiring removing
I don't know.
That's the question.
I think this will be so
confident.
I can stop whenever you want. I have a lot more slides, but I can go through them really quickly and skip stuff. So I can skip the last part because it's more like it's newer stuff. I'll just skip it.
Okay, what's the feeling after continuing for another hour or two?
Oh, gee.
Keep the discussion the way we're having it.
No, not an hour or two. That's a straw man.
So it's 20 minutes?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Except for another 20 minutes. Give her a chance to sort of finish and present the things that she wants to present, maybe in another five, and then we're going to take 15 minutes to continue discussing, okay?
I would appreciate it. I think it would be helpful to the process if we tried not to have multiple conversations, have a room full of chatter, if we could have a single voice speaking at each time.
I think it's a good sign to have a lot of chatter.
A lot of chatter. It's better than having no chatter. It shows interest, but...
Depends on what they're talking about.
No, I mean, chatter about what's going on.
I feel it's amazing success. This workshop already is doing exactly what it should be doing.
Okay.
And that was the whole idea. It's informal. You throw it in and pick it up.
So I actually have no idea where I was when we started with this. I think I was here.
That's where you were.
Maybe? Okay. Sorry. Yeah, so I think I defined streaks and roles and talked about how these definitions might be different, but we wanted a quantitative measure. And so if you look at the roles and the streak and the evolution between the RNL and the DNS, you can actually see that at least the streaks are extremely similar in terms of amplitude. The role is a little off, but again, we've got a pretty severe dynamical restriction. So even quantitatively, these things look pretty good. You can look at a temporal spectra sort of thing. These are just the Fourier coefficients. And you can see that they, you know, they're actually quite similar, except in the roles. Here, but the streaks, again, are very similar. So you're actually getting very similar type behavior out of this extreme dynamical restriction. And as I said there, there's actually only three modes in the X direction that I'm using here. So the other ones decayed naturally when I took away my excitation, so I didn't limit it. It's just that's naturally what happens. And so we are...
The energy of the roles now is the same order of magnitude.
These are just the Fourier coefficients, the norms of the Fourier coefficients.
But what does that mean?
It's just to give you an idea. So that the reason we calculated that is because it wasn't clear if, you know, the temporal variations of these things were similar. So we wanted to check the temporal variations, and this gave us a way to check the temporal variations.
You're talking about the temporal Fourier coefficients?
Yes. Oh, it doesn't even say that. Sorry. It says omega.
It's omega. We'll take that.
All right.
It says omega, yes.
It says it.
Oh, yes.
Oh, and I thought the omega was the vorticity.
All right. I don't know what to say. Okay. I lost where I was going. But that's okay. We'll move on. So I think I'm going to skip all of this. And so I talked about the momentum transfer coming from the streamwise constant non-linearity, and that this interaction between the perturbation dynamics and these mean flow dynamics are what really allows us to self-sustain turbulence at sort of a level that makes sense. And I was going to talk a little bit about looking at transition to a turbulent state in this type of model versus DNS, mm-hmm. but in the interest of time, maybe I should skip that.
No, but I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, no, but I'm just one person, and I'm not in the leadership.
You said five more minutes, so I kind of...
What do you call leading from behind?
at least tell us what's on the next slide.
I'm raising my hand, so I get to ask the question. So in the previous one, where you compared the streaks and roles, what was the Reynolds number of that? It was low.
1,000. Right? That was low.
Yeah,
that
1,000.
Was low.
Okay.
That, I mean, it's... For you, it's like zero.
But my question associated with that is that you've made a comment a couple times to scale separation. You're using that to some sort of advantage. And so 1,000 seems pretty marginal to be exploiting that. Can you comment
right.
on
so
that?
So in terms of the scale separation, I was just talking about scale separation in terms of the KX values in terms of things that are infinitely long versus things that are shorter. I wasn't talking about scale separation in terms of, you know, viscous, you know, inertial versus,
scale.
Yeah, so not Reynolds number scale separation. And it does turn out that when you move this to higher Reynolds numbers, you need to be a little bit more careful with what you're doing in terms of the streamwise spectra. And I can show you some of that stuff offline. I was trying to just look at the low Reynolds number stuff for this part. Okay, so...
You can settle this question of whether... Okay, but go ahead.
What was the question?
Nothing.
I'm so lost.
Go on.
Focus on this.
Okay, so, sorry, I have jet lag and I got up at 3:30 in the morning today, so my brain's not so good. We're just looking at comparing the DNS and the RNL. These are the same equations that I showed you before. I just want to point out that I'm triggering transition to turbulence using this zero mean, you know, white in space and time in both cases, just to trigger the turbulence. So they're divergence free. So they're not really white because we made them divergence free. So in one direction it's not white, and they're used to trigger turbulence. And we set them to the minimum value required for it to transition at a Reynolds number of 400. And so that's different in both models what the minimum value is. So just to give you that information. And so this is really preliminary work, but I find it kind of interesting, so that's why I'm presenting it. So in both of the DNS and the RNL, we have these three qualitatively similar stages of behavior. And again, now I'm looking at things where I'm subtracting out the laminar flow, because I want to look at transition, so I want to look at the difference between the full flow and the laminar. So we have in the DNS and the RNL, we have sort of this pre-transition phase where the spacing of the structures is given by essentially the width of the channel, and you have these sort of structures that are just basically channel spanning. As you start to transition, you start to get some momentum redistribution that's happening here. And then as you get into the sort of pre-turbulent state, you actually get a change in the feature spacing that's happening in both of these. You can see that actually the spacing is different in both of the models, but you get sort of three qualitatively similar type behaviors. So if we go back to looking at the streak development in the transition pre-transition phase, so we can look at that in both the DNS and the RNL. You can see it started with just white noise, because that's what we started with. And you can then see that you sort of get these structures that start to form that are channel spanning. And as this is happening in time, you can sort of see that the streak is growing and growing and growing until it gets to a certain point. And you can again see that the DNS streak is growing slower than the RNL streak. So in some sense, this equation is less stable. But you get a similar type of behavior. But you can see that the RNL actually, it happens quicker. And so this is already moving into the second stage, where this is just in the first stage here. As you can see, this happened here versus here. And I went to about this time. And so then the next stage, you go from this type of behavior. So now I'm looking at both the perturbation energy and the roll energy as opposed to the streak energy, because what was happening before, and it's quite interesting, is the perturbation energy wasn't really changing that whole time the streak was growing, and neither was the roll energy. So it was really just the streak growing. And so this sort of lends to this idea of these interactions between what's driving the streak and what's driving the roll, which is, I think, very, very interesting. And so then you get to the pre-transition phase, where you now have changed you have this feature spacing that's about 5 here and about 4 here. And then in the end, if you look at the streak and the roll, you go from having more structures to having a smaller number of structures, and you start to get the feature spacing that we actually see in the fully turbulent channel. And so this shows how the flow is transitioning in both of these cases. And so you can just sort of recap. What happens is you get this big streak growth, and when the streak gets to a certain height, then the roll basically almost immediately is formed, and then the roll starts to sustain, and that's when you start to get this type of feature spacing that looks more like a turbulent flow. So we get this quantitatively similar transition process, and we're trying to understand a little bit about what's driving this feature spacing and why it's different in both models. And I want to thank John for his channel flow codes that we're using for all of this. And that's all I was going to talk about modulo what I skipped.
So, Denise, it seems to me, the thing I don't understand here, it seems to me this approach has to require X length scale, which is smaller than the correlation length of the flows that are generated.
Smaller,
so that if you imagine you take this thing where you're simulating, you're doing a 2D, you know, basically that you're fundamentally, you're trying to get a 2D simulation of a mean flow, which is the streamwise mean.
Yeah,
if you let the length of the simulation go to infinity, then you have no spanwise features because the just by homogeneity, just because, you know, what's if the streamwise length goes to infinity, then you have some rolls over here, but then down there the rolls are offset a little bit, you know, average over x infinite, and then you shouldn't have any spanwise features.
I think that's theoretically true, yeah. Although we've looked at 96 pi channels and it's still there. So theoretically, I think that's true asymptotically. You know, when I write it down, that makes perfect sense to me. But again, I can show you our simulations in a 96 pi channel, and these features are still there. We still have streaks. We still have rolls. You know, their magnitudes. I can show you what the magnitudes are.
Let me just understand when.
So in streaks means streak. By the way, I defined it.
When you say we still have streaks, that means in your model, in the model,
in the simulation,
in the DNS of the 96,
in the restricted nonlinear simulation,
in the RNL.
Yeah, and so
you did a DNS. Yeah, well.
So we can't do a DNS of a 96 pi channel, not with the code we have. But you do, because we still have streaks, it means we still have spanwise variation, because of the way I define streaks as being the mean minus the spanwise variation. So if there is no spanwise variation, then, I mean, minus the spanwise average. So if there was no spanwise variation, the streak would go away. That's what I wanted to make clear, because it's the way I'm defining the streak that tells me that there's still spanwise variation.
Okay. But even so, then think about the spanwise length of the wide periodic box you've got as a parameter. Mm-hmm. You know, if you shrink it down to this length, then you don't have any, you know, streamwise variation. Then you get streamwise constant. If you shrink it to zero, you have a streamwise constant flow.
If you shrink the spanwise?
The streamwise length is zero. Right. Then you don't have any streamwise variation, and it goes to lambda. If you let it go to infinity.
So I showed you that if I have noise that's coming in and I don't, and there's no streamwise variation in the noise, it doesn't go back to laminar.
Okay, in your model.
In a simulation. So
big U is the same big U all the way down. So even if she makes her thing long, that roll is still in the same place. So the little U is going to respond sort of in the same way downstream.
And so with the perturbations that are streamwise varying, you do get what looks like streamwise variation in the flow field.
They're never going to be uncorrelated because they're correlated through big U.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's important. Otherwise, what you say is true. You would get a spanwise invariant forcing in the whole thing.
This big, like, so when I say this mean flow that I'm defining and making sure I have a rational mean flow is important, it's critical. And that's why I don't know that this would work in other flows, because it's not clear how you would define such a mean flow in other flows. You may very well be able to do that. You may be able to find a coordinate frame where that makes sense, but this is something where, you know, the flow naturally lends itself.
So, in some sense, the mean flow, the 2D flow that you're simulating is not really necessarily the mean of, of a real flow.
It's not a time average mean. I mean, it depends on how you define a mean.
Yeah, it's the street.
That would be invariant in spanwise.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And that's
it's kx equals zero, not kz equals zero. So I think we're.
Yeah.
How does or does this process allow the wavy part of the self-sustaining process to take place? Is that clear to everybody, or
no? It's not. It's not clear.
I mean, because you don't have in X, you don't have no wave numbers. You don't have just X. So you have a bunch of a small number of. Are those sufficient to make a wavy?
Yeah.
It's not clear. I think it would be really interesting to make sure that that's true by looking at what we have and comparing it to these streaky structures. And
because the waviness of the self-sustaining process, its wavelength is known, sort of.
Exactly.
So you must know if you have that wavelength in your X variation.
And I can tell you I don't always.
But it
doesn't.
Ingredient in your model of self-sustaining. It's a different
model. Right, so I don't have a model of self-sustaining. Yeah. I have something that self-sustains.
Yeah.
Which is different than a model of self-sustaining. So it's not, my answer is really I don't see a direct link to that, and the terms that I'm leaving out may make what's going on slightly different. I don't know. And I think that connection is important because there are some arguments about exactly what's happening between various people.
It doesn't have to be exactly quantitatively what
exactly.
It has to exist somehow.
Yeah, so, or a process like that needs to exist, and that's not, I don't know how to quantify that, is my answer, and I really want to figure out how to compare those things.
If I may just point out, if you look at this nine-mode model, all the assumptions and all the approximations are exactly in there, and you can follow term by term what you keep and what you drop, and how you get sort of the self-sustaining process. So this is something that can be done on sort of on the order of nine ordinary differential equations. And then you generalize it to more degrees of freedom.
But it doesn't have the same nonlinear restriction, so it might not map directly to what we're doing.
The approximations that you make are all in there.
So oh, they are. Okay.
Yeah.
Have you looked at the model on really small boxes, we talked about yesterday?
We've looked at it on the minimal channel.
Keep getting smaller and smaller, does it eventually break down? Or
yeah, so the minimal channel.
With the small,
the minimal channel for RNL is a little bit different than it is for DNS.
What is it?
I don't remember exactly. It's 1.75 by 1.2.
For the shear flow.
Is it?
The minimal size of the box that your self-sustaining process can occur.
So my PhD student told me that it's different, but we can sustain in that minimal channel too. But the minimal is different, but what we simulate is the real minimal channel. That's a better answer, sorry.
So could you put back your plots?
I'm not sure.
Of the rolls and the streaks. It was very near the end. About the transition, I want to ask you a question about fluid mechanics.
About what?
Yeah. I guess I'm just not sure that I can do this.
Okay, so the point is you saw the streaks grow very large and that the amplitude grew, and you said the roll energy wasn't going anywhere until some critical threshold.
Yes. Yep.
Now, when you had the RNL and the DNS were kind of similar, you might argue there was more variance in the RNL, but they were very similar. Have you looked at that? One of the sort of controversies is that extra step describable by a linear instability, and the state has just evolved to some state that is then linearly unstable to some process? Have you done that analysis?
No. But I think that's the next step. That's why I'm smiling, because that's exactly one of the things that this is fairly new work, and the postdoc left. After he gave me these slides, he said, you know, here you go. You need to find somebody to finish this. So it's kind of hanging work. But yes, this is one of the questions that I said, well, can we do this before you leave?
Yeah, particularly with the RNL, it's very key.
Can you say your thing again? Just say it again.
So the streak energy is growing.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
It's growing very rapidly.
Yes, yes.
Yet at some instant.
Yes.
Something happens to the roll energy that grows very rapidly and it breaks.
Yes.
And if you think about the mathematics of that, it is you've got a very rapidly changing base state, and yet the base state, when it reaches some particular amplitude, appears to then trigger an instability to fly off in another direction. When you don't have scale separation, you're not going to be able to say, I have this frozen in time background state. And yet it kind of looks like it's linearly unstable.
Okay.
And so that's a very interesting, to me, that's an interesting question.
I agree with you.
But why do you want linear instability instead of just this causes that? Why linear instability?
Well, because some people do. You know, there are papers out there where they say that it's a hierarchy of, you look at this state and it is linearly unstable. You can, if you freeze that state, it still gives you structures that look very much like the things that then grow, even though the timescale separation isn't there.
So there are a lot of different theories about exactly what's going on there. I mean, there's, you know, so many different papers that have slight variations, and you know, some of them say it's not unstable, it's marginally stable until you get some sort of critical layer. You know, there's lots of different theories.
But you really seem to have a handle on the streaks grow. What you call streaks grow, and they reach some amplitude, and then then it goes completely right. And so what is about that state that is the threshold is of interest?
I think so. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why studying this model is kind of interesting versus looking at maybe an LES is we kind of understand the physics that we have there. We know what we put into it. And so we can then study it. And when we get an answer from that, we actually know exactly how we restricted the system. So then if we want to try and understand something about how that relates back to Navier-Stokes, we have a direct path in some sense, and that's one of the reasons to look at this.
Just to say there are systems where that exact thing happens, like the if you drive jets on a sphere on a beta plane, then the jets get to a certain amplitude where there is a secondary instability of the jets, and then that modifies the and that is very well analyzed by looking at exactly the kind of quasi-linear system that Denise is looking at. I've no idea whether it's happening here, because the other system is 2D, it's much easier to analyze.
Yeah.
I think this is as well, right?
Eber and Wally.
So it's called, do you feel that that has a relationship to the work that Tom has done?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, what are you driving in that direction?
Yeah, because you can then represent it as the low number of Koopman-like modes, you know, and it seems to be that you then hit an unstable manifold, you run off...
It's possible, but I haven't done the analysis yet. Maybe we can do that this workshop.
How do you select your streamwise wave numbers?
So in everything I showed you, I didn't. I just let it do what it decided to do.
So you had how many? So you did your simulation with how many modes?
I did my simulation with all of the modes. I saw a whole bunch of them naturally fell away, and then I redid the simulation with about five more modes than actually are actually active.
So all your modes are integer multiples of one another.
I mean, they're kx, 1, 2, 3, depending on how you define it. One of my students defines it as 0.5.
They're all multiples of a single wave number, yes?
The way she does it, yes.
How else do you do wave numbers?
Because you said you looked at which were large, and I could imagine you'd take it.
I didn't look at what was large. I just put in everything, and I saw that everything above a certain kx decayed, and it doesn't make sense to simulate a whole bunch of things that are to do computations of things that are consistently zero. So when we did the simulation again to do more results, we just took out a bunch of things that were zero so it was faster to compute.
And how many were they in some of the results?
There's three that are active. We're simulating nine.
Yeah.
Just to make sure.
But this is only at one Reynolds number, right?
So this the results I showed you were only at one Reynolds number. I have results at other Reynolds numbers.
Or different ones.
Changing the box size also changes the number you need, because it's really about the structures, the size of the structures that is important, not the particular numbers, kx numbers. It's a physics thing, mm-hmm. I think. I don't think that's as irresponsible a speculation. It's got to be a physics thing.
Okay.
Done?